We're going to turn the corner tonight and introduce the New Testament. Now, probably going to go over a lot of this in January once we restart, because I don't know if we'll remember this after several weeks now. But I think it might be helpful for us. Look on, I guess really page 12 is what I meant. But we did this last week, I think on page 10 and 11, and looked at the entirety of the Old Testament, the divisions of the Old Testament books, and you see how much we've covered from when we started this and where we ended up. And then last week, I feel like I so thoroughly confused you, because I went through that 400 years between the Old Testament and New Testament. I had somebody this week, and they listen online each week to Wednesday and Sunday, and they don't even attend here at the church, and I saw him. And he said, I really enjoyed, he said, it was neat how, you know, Sunday you talked about John the Baptist and, you know, silence there before. And then Wednesday night, you know, he said, I kind of followed the empires and all that. So it was kind of encouraging to me. So we did that last week, and we're turning the corner. So what I think might help as we start into the New Testament is on page 12, yeah, I guess just page 12 of your book, there is... And we did this early on in the study. But there is a way of looking at the New Testament books. There's 27 New Testament books. Is that correct? And 39 Old Testament. And just like we did with the Old Testament, you can also take the New Testament books and divide those into sections that help you understand a little bit of, I'm going to say, the genre. Okay, what kind of books these are. And people are so confused. They don't understand. The average person, you flip a Bible open, and even if it landed in the New Testament, they are so confused. They don't realize how it is unified and follows a theme. So when you turn to the New Testament, which we're going to start tonight, the first four books we call the Gospels. So we've got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So four times in your Bible, you have the account of Jesus' life, his ministry, his death, his burial, his resurrection. I happen to believe that if God repeats something four times, it's probably pretty foundational, pretty important. So four times you've got pretty lengthy books that give you an account from different perspectives of the life of this Messiah that John the Baptist prophesied and spoke of, and Zacharias did, as we saw Sunday. Then you've got one book of New Testament history. Now, that is the book of Acts. Basically, you've got four Gospels that are going to carry you to the resurrection. After Jesus is raised from the dead, the church is going to be born. The church comes into existence in Acts, in the book of Acts. So then the book of Acts gives you a history of all that happened almost until, I'm going to say, about the year 64 to 68, somewhere in there, AD. So about 30 to 40 years of history after Jesus' death and resurrection. Okay, that's the book of Acts. It's history. In the book of Acts, you have a dude named Paul, takes missionary journeys and starts a bunch of churches. Okay. Now, because he starts a bunch of churches, the next section of your New Testament is the letters that Paul wrote to those churches or individuals in the churches. Sometimes those letters are called epistles. And I jokingly say that an epistle is not the wife of an apostle, because some people, you know, kind of joke about that. It's not. Epistle is a $10 word that simply means letter. Now, when you met the person that, well, whether you married the person or not, when you met a person that you thought you were in love with, you started to write love letters, and we call those love letters, we don't call them love epistles. Nobody does that, but that's the formal word for a letter, and especially ones we find in the Bible. Of the letters of the New Testament, you've got 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 13 that Paul wrote. So those are called Pauline epistles, okay, written by Paul's letters. Then you've also got, after Paul's letters, Then you've got what are known as general epistles or general letters. These are written by other apostles in addition to Paul. So, for example, you've got James, Peter, Apostle John, and then Jude. Now, the book of Hebrews, we don't know for sure which apostle wrote this book. Some argue Paul, some argue Luke. I think I've heard, Apollos? And I've heard different, Barnabas, I've heard different names, and we don't know because it doesn't state the author of the book. After you get through the letters, Paul's letters and general letters, then you've got one book of New Testament prophecy. And that obviously is the book called the Revelation, okay, the unveiling. And we're going through that on Sunday mornings and kick back into gear next year. Probably second Sunday of January, we'll get back into that. So when you take the New Testament and you've had 27 books, you can break it up into sections, and it helps you understand, already gives you a running start into what these different letters are about. Now, what most people don't realize, just like in the Old Testament, when you get to the book of Ezra and Nehemiah in the Old Testament, you are done with Old Testament history. Every prophet now fits into that history. Okay, same thing kind of happens in the New Testament. When you get through the book of Acts, a lot of the letters in the rest of your New Testament now fit into the history of Acts. So Paul travels, he writes letters to Colossae, to Philippi, to Ephesus. Okay, these all fit into the history of the book of Acts. And then the general epistles a little bit later in the first century, then leading to the book of Revelation. So for me, it helps when I look at the New Testament to kind of break it up and see, have some idea of what these different sections are. And it also helps me to memorize and locate the books too. Because if you tell me to turn to Luke and I don't have a clue which section of the New Testament that's in, well, I might start looking at Revelation backing up. Well, no, don't do that. It's in the Gospel, so start at the beginning and go that way. So, anything about that little outline that helps or hurts, or you got a question about? So, just kind of keep that page in mind as we go through this. So, let's start tonight. Let's start tonight in the Gospels, and this is lesson 44 of your book, so page 211. And I want to begin by reading the first part of this, and really neat information in here that I had never thought about before until I went through this a couple years ago. So, first of all, the word gospel means good news. Okay, you've probably heard that before, and in case you get on Jeopardy, I'm going to give you the, this is more than a $10 word. It's probably a $25 word. But since we're trying to understand the Bible and you might end up on Jeopardy or Final Jeopardy, it might be worth it. So let me explain to you where that comes from. I know, it looks, you're going to say it looks like Greek to me. You're right, it's Greek. So, but the reason I want to show you this is the word gospel is euangelion. Now, why I'm saying that is this. If you break this word up, the word you means good. Now think about this. When you go to a funeral and someone shares a eulogy, okay, let me write it out. They share a eulogy, break it up. You, it means good, and logos means word, right? So when you give a eulogy for a person's funeral, you're giving a good word about that person. That's what eulogy means. Same thing. So, you means good, and the angelion part means a message. So, if you take the word, the literal word gospel, it simply means good message or good news. Now, you've got four books in the New Testament that are known as good newses. I just pluralized it. They're known as gospels, right? They're known as good newses. They're good news books. They're gospel books. They're books about the euangelion. Okay, that's what these four books are. So the word gospel simply means good news. Jesus, of course, brought good news from God. He called his message of salvation the gospel. And there's four books written about the life, death, resurrection, of Jesus from Nazareth that came to be known as the Gospels. Now, let me point out something, and this is just because I'm a picky person, but just make sure you do it correctly. When you talk about the books of the Bible, it's a capital G. When you're referring to the actual gospel message, it's lowercase g. So that means that if you write it incorrectly, then I've got permission to like slap you, right? I say that kind of joking with people sometimes, but people don't realize when I talk about the Gospel of Matthew, Gospel according to Matthew, that's a capital G. It's a title of a book. But if I'm sharing the gospel with somebody, that's lowercase g. It's just good news. And the book points that out. And that way you can be more impressive to people who care. All right. So they became known as the Gospels, capitalized for the book names. And they tell how the good news came to us. Now, you've got four. Each of the four Gospels is unique. And that's what I think is going to really help as we go through the next couple of lessons. Each gospel is unique. They come from a different perspective, different authors. Each book presents a different viewpoint of the gospel story. And they ask the question, why do you think God gave us four gospels that tell the same story? And I kind of think, first of all, it emphasizes, he repeats it four times, it must be important. It's kind of what I think. But number two, you know this, if several of us were witness to an incident of some sort, I promise you we would not all recall the exact same details of that incident. Now, we have the general storyline right, but we all be coming from a different perspective. So when you get four Gospels, you're getting a more full, complete picture of Jesus' life, coming from more of a theological mind with John, more of a Jewish mind with Matthew. Okay, they're bringing in a more complete picture of that good news, the euangelion that it talks about. Now, here's what I really like. I will say this. When I bought this book, this little net section here was worth the price of the book. I have never seen anybody ever point this out. This is neat. Four Gospels comprise of 89 chapters. Now, look what happens here. Four of those 89 chapters cover the first 30 years of Jesus' life. 85 of those chapters are devoted to the last 3 years of his life. And then 27 of those 85 actually cover the last 8 days of his life. Now, you ask the question, why don't we know much about Jesus' childhood? We don't know much about his teenage years. Well, the reason for that is the gospel writers chose really not to share that information. I mean, truly, look at it. Out of 89 or whatever chapters it was, only four talk about the first, what did it say, 30 years of his life. And most of those are his birth, right? Luke, Matthew 1 and 2 and Luke 1 and 2. That's probably the four right there, if I'm just thinking off the top of my head. And yet, the very end of his life, that's what they focus on. Okay, the last part of his ministry, turns 30 years old. That's what they really focus on. I don't know why. There's one spot. Is it in Luke? It's either Luke or Mark. I want to say Luke. There's one spot where it does reference when Jesus was 12 years old. And he went up to the temple. And he baffled all the preachers. But that's it. You have nothing else in the New Testament about his upbringing. So you can fill in the blanks a lot. Now, I've often thought, since we don't know, I wonder how jealous his half-siblings got at times. Because he never did wrong. Imagine all, like, you know, James is a half-brother and different ones, and he's got some half-sisters. And what if they, like, get in trouble for something? They look at Jesus and say, look, you never get in trouble, do you? Sinless, perfect, they never. And then imagine growing up in school, I mean, their education with what they did, like, he just always knew the answer. Dude's 12 years old in the temple arguing with the scholars. Like, where'd you come from? Can you imagine that? So I kind of wish we did have some of his childhood, but we don't. So the emphasis is clearly on the last part of his life, death, burial, and resurrection. Okay, that's the introduction to these first four books. So anything there you want to share, add, ask? Okay, let's start here. So we're going to begin with Matthew, and I don't know if we'll get through all of this tonight. It's going to be close. And then, like I said, next year we will pick up with this and we'll show how all four come together. So Matthew, I would say, okay, in my opinion, this is the most important thing to remember with Matthew's gospel that really sets him apart. Matthew's gospel is known as, we're going to say, more of a Jewish perspective. And you're going to see that as we go through this section, this paragraph. So Matthew wrote to the Jews. Now, Mark, Luke, okay, they were writing to a different audience. But Matthew specifically is addressing the Jewish people who need to accept that Jesus of Nazareth is the Messiah. Now, one reason that we say that, and this is key to me. If you go through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and count the number of times they reference the Old Testament, Matthew references the Old Testament more than any other gospel writer. Why does he do that? Because he is using the Jewish Bible to try to convince the Jewish people that Jesus is a Jewish Messiah. So all through his gospel, you're going to find quotations of the Old Testament. Now, Mark may share a similar story and never give you the Old Testament quotation. But Matthew does, because he's focusing on a Jewish audience. So 93 quotations from the Old Testament, and he's setting out to prove that Jesus is a promised king from the book of Isaiah. That Jesus is a promised king from the book of Zechariah. Okay, he's using the Old Testament to try to convince the Jews that he is their Messiah. Today, the Chosen People Ministries and other Jewish organizations, they do the exact same thing. Mitch Glazer, I think, is the name of the guy that runs Chosen People Ministries. And we had one of his representatives here several years ago for our, I think it was like a Hanukkah thing he did. And their entire ministry is using the Old Testament to prove to Jewish people that Jesus is a Messiah. They don't use the New Testament because the Jewish people don't accept the New Testament. So they use the Old Testament. That's what Matthew is doing. He's trying to convince the Jewish people that he is their promised king and their Messiah. As we continue with Matthew, as he focuses on the Jewishness of the Messiah, and I kind of said this already, he's trying to show the Jews that Jesus fulfilled the Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah. And I don't know if this will be on the same... Okay, it is. One of the things that's key for Matthew, he's got to prove as well that Jesus comes from the family of King David. Okay, why is that key? Well, you remember in 2 Samuel chapter 7, we had something called the Davidic Covenant. And in that Davidic Covenant, God said to David, I'm going to give you an eternal kingdom. You're going to always have an heir to sit on the throne forever. And when he points to an eternal kingdom, we find in the New Testament that Jesus is the son of David. He's often referred to as the son of David. When they say that, they're pointing back to the promise made to David in 2 Samuel 7. So what Matthew does, he's going to also prove to the people, when they think about the Messiah, that indeed he has come from the family of King David, because that's fulfilling their Jewish scripture and their prophecy. Now, second thing I would say that's really key. I must have skipped that. Did I skip that? I did skip that. All right. So Matthew's trying to prove that Jesus is a promised Messiah. I just said that. All right. Second king thing I think is key in Matthew is what he focuses on. So if I were making a list of distinctions with Matthew compared to Mark, Luke, and John, I would say number one, Matthew has a lot more of a Jewish perspective as he writes his gospel. Number two, Matthew really, really focuses on the teachings. Okay? And I think the book is going to say this next. in Matthew, you find a very large majority of Jesus' parables because it's focusing on the teaching. Now, I'm not going to go over it now, but if you look it up, you will find in the book of Matthew, there are five very large discourses that's pure teaching. So Sermon on the Mount is one section. Chapter 24, Sermon on the Mount of Olives. Okay, that's a second large discourse. Matthew focuses on the teachings in large sections of teachings more than Mark, Luke, or John. So if I were asked what's two distinctives with Matthew, I'd say number one is a Jewish gospel. Number two, he focuses big time on the teaching ministry that Christ had. Okay, records more parables of the kingdom than other gospel writers. And they didn't really emphasize this, but that word kingdom is also key. The primary theme of Jesus' ministry was the kingdom of God. Now, we think it was miracles or healing people. His primary ministry was the kingdom. That was his focus, was the kingdom of God. The rule and reign of God. That was his primary focus. So you would expect, if Matthew is more of a gospel or Jewish-oriented writer, that's what he is going to focus on. Oh, and I forgot to tell you, too. Let's put this up here at the top, and this doesn't really apply there. But I also forgot to tell you, don't forget in the New Testament, when Matthew became a follower of Christ, he was an IRS agent, right? He was a tax collector. He was kind of an evil dude. I mean, right? He's stealing from people and taking more money than he should. And we actually looked at that when we talked about individuals that Jesus encountered. His name was also Levi in the New Testament. Matthew, same person. So the writer of this gospel was basically an IRS agent who got saved. And I know you didn't think they could get saved, but they can. It's a little harder. Jesus said, right, it's easier. What did you say? Easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to get to heaven? Because people depend on wealth so much. And it's hard for them to get saved, but they can. And Matthew was one of them who did. So, first gospel you have, written by a money-hungry tax guy. He gets saved. He comes from a Jewish perspective, and he focuses a lot on the teachings and parables of Jesus' ministry. Okay, that's a summary of Matthew. So, give me anything that stands out you want to ask, add, challenge. Oh, I guess I got one more little thing here. I got so many pages of notes, I'm trying to keep it straight here. Okay. So, I think I did leave off. I forgot there was another little section here, too. So, it is an example of his teachings. When you think about the Sermon on the Mount, and you know we all are familiar with that, starts with the Beatitudes. So as an example of his emphasis on the teaching ministry, Luke also records the Sermon on the Mount. But what you find is Matthew gives a lot more information about the account or the sermon than Luke does. So it's just an example of how he focuses more on the teaching and discourse. Okay. Let's just start it a little bit. I probably shouldn't, but I think we got a few minutes here. So that's Matthew. Now look at the next little section there. Second book in the New Testament is a gospel according to Mark. And we're going to come back and touch on these more in the next couple lessons too. But Mark, what makes him different? First of all, let me put this up here, and I probably won't get much further than this at this point. So Mark, in the New Testament, his full name, he's known as John Mark. It's sort of like John Boy. You just like call him John, right? All right, so this is John Mark, but in the New Testament, oftentimes they kind of drop this part of his name and just call him kind of like the nickname of Mark. But if you read in the book of Acts, you'll find a reference to John Mark, I believe. And that's the same person as this Mark. So, Mark, let me put this up here too. So, Mark's name is John Mark. We find that in the New Testament. And this is something a little bit different about Mark's gospel. It is believed that Mark got most of his information for his gospel from Peter, okay, the Apostle Peter. Now, the reason for that, if you go back in early church history, there is a church historian who makes that statement, like early on, that Mark actually got his information from the Apostle Peter. Okay, that's what gives Mark's gospel apostolic authority. It's coming straight from the Apostle Peter, and now he writes that for us. So that's two things about Mark as we start. So Matthew, we said, addresses his gospel more to the Jewish people. Now, Mark does not address his so much to the Jewish people as much as to the Roman people. So this is going to be more of our Gentiles. They don't understand Jewish customs. They don't understand Jewish allusions like Matthew's readers are going to understand. So Mark is not going to include as much Jewish stuff. He's not going to include Old Testament reference like Matthew. He's not writing to Jewish people. Okay, that's the example. Again, if we witness an incident, one person is going to come from their perspective, another comes from their perspective, and we get a fuller picture. Okay, Mark is coming from a different perspective. He's not focusing on a Jewish audience like Matthew. So when you go back in history, again, don't know for sure, but it seems that he's writing to the Romans, and then some of the early church fathers think that he also wrote while he was in Rome itself. So in Mark, when Mark gets to a Jewish concept, he's going to pause and explain it for his readers. They don't already know it. They're not Jewish people. So a lot of times in Mark's gospel, you'll find him use an Aramaic term, and then in parentheses he'll say, oh, that means this, by the way, because they don't understand. And that's a little bit of a distinction. Another thing with Mark, and I think this is probably worth putting on our list up here. Mark, how should I word this? I know they call it simple facts. Okay, let's say this. Mark kind of keeps it simple and sweet. Okay, now, okay, how many chapters are in Matthew? 28, I think. How many chapters are in Mark? 16. Right? Okay, so Mark is not quite as long-winded. You know? He's like, all right, here it is, boom, 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 let's move on. Okay, that's Mark. He doesn't explain a lot. He doesn't unpack Jewish, or doesn't focus on the Jewish stuff as much. When he does hit it, he's got to explain it, but he hits it quick and moves on. Okay, it's kind of simple, short, sweet. All right, I ain't got time for this, let's go on, kind of thing. Okay, he's a real fast-paced type of writer. One little thing also neat with Mark, and this again may be because he got his information from Peter. As Mark shares the information about Jesus' life, it almost always comes from the perspective of an eyewitness. And if you go back into early church history and you read the statement that Mark got most of his information from Peter, that makes sense. Because last time I checked in the Bible, Peter was there for a lot of this stuff. He was an eyewitness. And Mark draws on that information from Peter.